Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber. On today's show, when the FBI spies on journalists. This summer, The Intercept, a publication that focuses on surveillance issues, obtained classified rules revealing the largely unrestrained procedure for by which the FBI obtains journalists' call information and other electronic communications that are critical to reporting using something called national security letters. Joining me to discuss this is the author of the story, Cora Currier, a reporter for The Intercept, and her focus is on national security and human rights. Cora, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So just high level, what did you find in these letters? What was the most striking thing to you?
Well, what we obtained were the rules for the FBI to issue what's known as a national security letter. So these are warrantless demands that the FBI issues to companies, telecom companies for the most part, but they can also send them to banks and get certain financial information through them. But mostly they're going to telecom companies to get metadata of people's calls. So who's called who and when, toll records of what you'd see on your phone bill. And what was unknown was whether there were specific procedures for when the FBI wanted to target a journalist, that there was like some separate set of rules governing journalists' records as opposed to anybody else's. But we didn't know what they were. Because they had been issued, the FBI guidebook, which laid them out, had been last released in 2011 in a really heavily redacted form, and the entire section on the media rules were blacked out. So,
was not a case of the FBI announcing how it targets journalists. This was information that was obtained, theoretically through a whistleblower or through a leak, right? I mean, the reason we know about this is because of your story. This wasn't some memo where they basically were telling us how they do stuff.
No, it wasn't something the FBI made public. They've, in fact, like I said, they've released these sort of the guidelines, but with just censored, this entire section censored. So we got a hold of the uncensored version of them. And this is actually something that a group had been suing for. They'd been suing the FBI over this precise issue for these precise records. And the FBI, the government so far, had not turned them over, had only turned over another redacted version of them. So what they show is, as is often the case with redactions, it's really hard to understand why they, what the justification for keeping this very procedural thing secret was. But basically, it shows that they don't need very much extra sign-off if they want to target a journalist as opposed to anybody else. I mean, the standard for a national security letter is quite low anyway. You just have to certify that it is relevant to a national security investigation. And again, it doesn't go through a judge. It's just requires an FBI supervisor's sign-off. If, according to these rules that we obtained, there's one extra step if the purpose of this national security letter goes to a journalist, wants to get at a journalist's records. Sorry, it doesn't go to a journalist, but the intent of it is to get the journalist's records. Then they need one extra sign off from a higher up. There's another step if the purpose of the national security letter is specifically to identify the journalist's sources. So in that case, they have to consult with the Assistant Attorney General for National Security in the Justice Department. So they do have to go to the Justice Department and talk to them about it if they want to use this method to identify a journalist's sources.
So the metadata, that's just they describe it as this procedural thing where they're getting a coworker, to look at it and make sure that everything's above board. But in practice, is this more like going up to your buddy at the water cooler and just being like, hey, can you sign this? I mean, is there any reason to believe that internal scrutiny and asking your fellow FBI coworkers to look at something, is that worth anything? Does that lead to better practices, or is it basically a rubber stamp?
Well, I think that getting the Justice Department involved, if they have to go, into the Justice Department, and the Justice Department is very sensitive to you know, when to target journalists, but that doesn't mean they don't. Like, I mean, we've seen under this administration some really aggressive aggressive approaches to journalists. I mean, it came out in 2013 that the Justice Department had secretly seized phone line records from like dozens of phone lines, or not dozens, but I think like about 20 phone lines at the Associated Press, and they'd physically surveilled a Fox News reporter, and that caused a big backlash. And so Attorney General Eric Holder put out this new set of rules saying, you know, prosecutors could only go after journalists as a last resort, and, you know, that the it would be an extraordinary measure, and that they would not do what they'd done with the Fox News journalist, which was label them as a co-conspirator in a leak investigation, so that they could more aggressively target them. However, there was a huge... There was a huge carve out in those Justice Department rules, which was that they didn't apply to national security tools like a national security letter. So the question remains, yeah, are these actually these internal safeguards on the national security letters are much less stringent than what Eric Holder put out in response to this you know, scandal.
And you have to wonder what the motivation for these investigations is. And of course, journalists talk to many people. They talk to sources within intelligence agencies. There are leaks. You know, agencies obviously want to keep a tight grip on information, but then journalists also talk to members of terrorist organizations. There's a lot of people that you need to know and be in contact with to do good reporting, especially in this particular beat. Now, maybe if the FBI just wants journalists to help them stop bad guys, that could be sympathetic. But is the real motivation just agencies trying to catch whistleblowers and find leaks and plug them? And that's really the reason that the Justice Department is going after journalists? Or is this because they truly want cooperation between journalists and agencies for the purposes of counterterrorism? Because maybe a casual listener could sympathize with true counterterrorism efforts, but if it's just the FBI trying to squash leaks and, you know, prevent people from, you know, tattling on their coworkers on the bad things they do at the Justice Department and FBI, maybe that's less sympathetic.
Well, I think that you know, national security letters, when we hear about them at all, they're justified in these really dire terms, like, you know, this is an essential national security tool. This is about counterintelligence or terrorism. You know, it's about catching terrorists and spies. But what was actually interesting about these rules when I, you know, shared them with Freedom of the Press advocates, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, which has been looking a lot at this, you know, they were somewhat surprised at how explicitly the guidelines were actually talking about identifying leakers. They were like, you know, that is, you know, what does that mean in terms, like, if we're using this tool to identify leakers, and we have specific procedures in place for you know, using it in this way, you know, how is that, generally speaking, you know, related to a national security concern? You know, I mean, almost any leak investigation that we're, I mean, there are leak investigations that don't relate to national security, but, you know, the high profile ones do. Most of the ones we've heard about recently do. And, you know, leak prosecutions, while they've increased over this presidency, are still pretty rare and still pretty a serious thing. So, you know, they often have to do with national security. So, you know, if almost all of the leak investigations have to do with national security, and this is a tool that they're like explicitly using for leak investigations, you know, that certainly suggests that, like, you know, like you were saying, that that's really the purpose here of targeting the media, not to, you know, not for unrelated, you know, unrelated espionage or terrorism investigations that don't have to do with news gathering as it is.
Right. And from a human rights perspective, the biggest concern with when the government targets journalists or goes after them is what happens to the journalist. Because, I mean, in the United States, it's one thing to be a journalist. It's a very different thing to be a journalist in Russia and China. And we've seen people's lives be put in danger or ended or end up in prison as a result of the government spying on journalists. But that's obviously a major concern from a human rights level, but there's also the ability to do your job. And if you are trying to report on national security, I mean, one of the reasons your website is so prominent is because of an illegal act by Edward Snowden. So when the national security community just hides behind, well, if it's related to counterterrorism, it's super important. Well, of course it's related to counterterrorism. And it's also really important that people find out about this stuff so that we can have conversations like this that might not otherwise happen if not for those leaks. But how does this impact your ability to do your job on a personal level, maybe your coworkers? Is there a chilling effect? Are you afraid to pursue certain stories and leads because of the knowledge that the government might be snooping on your metadata, finding out who your source is, which could endanger their lives or at least endanger both of your reputations? I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but feel free to start wherever you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that just we have to constantly, you know, as a journalist working in the United States, looking at the United States government, you know, we have to constantly, there's definitely ways that the government can make a journalist's life difficult in the United States, but it's nothing like, as you were saying, the threats that journalists face in many, many other countries. So, you know, just the existence of these rules and the fact that it is, you know, such a politically sensitive thing to even look at a journalist's phone records, let alone listen in on their calls or whatever else it is, is some comfort. On the other, you know, we do have this strong tradition of press freedom, and that's great. On the other hand, I think that what the, you know, Snowden disclosures and, you know, just increased awareness of government surveillance generally and disclosures like this have helped do is make all of us, you know, all media, not just those working on super sensitive, national security programs, conscious of how much you expose not just yourself, but really how you expose your sources. Because I am, you know, I get these protections as a journalist, these extra set of rules, however, you know, light they are, I do get them. But my sources don't, right? My sources can be targeted in all sorts of ways. And, you know, it's actually in the, in these rules, they say that if they want to target someone who is not a journalist in order to see, you know, in order to find the source of a leak, they don't need to go through this extra step, right? Even if they're going to get a journalist's records in the process. So your sources are the ones that are really vulnerable. And I think it definitely changes. I'm not sure, at least in my case, it doesn't have a chilling effect, but it definitely, you know, makes me think about who I'm calling, how I approach people. I have to know that even just a cold call to somebody can, would leave a trail and make them vulnerable. I have to know that, I definitely know that anyone you speak to in government now is so much more nervous. Because even if it's an innocent conversation, even if you're asking them about completely unclassified things, there's a record of that phone call. And
right,
people are really nervous about that.
Yeah. And of course, we're having this conversation in the context of phone call metadata, which is one type of information that you can gather about someone that could really reveal a lot about how they work, how they put together stories, et cetera. But then there's other metadata that are out there, like your internet browsing history and how you look people up and what sites you rely on to gather information and put together a story. And that could be even more revealing in some cases. Are there concerns that those types of information are also going to be roped into this national security letter regime, or because of efforts by privacy advocates, is the pendulum swinging more towards privacy? I'm just kind of trying to get a sense of where we're headed from here, because you've identified a problem, this call metadata thing, and of course, The Intercept and groups like Tech Freedom, we are generally skeptical of what the government's doing and we want more safeguards and more oversight. But then there are people who say, look, we've got to fight terrorism and we should be giving more tools to law enforcement and more discretion. Are there efforts to include things like your emails and browsing history? Do you have any predictions on where this debate's going to go?
There actually is an ongoing legislative debate right now about what exactly the FBI can ask for in a national security letter. Again, this is records that they can ask for without going to a judge. So it has its own particular definition. And traditionally, this was just, like we said, telephone toll records, right? So that's not supposed to, that's just to, you know, who called when, who called who, when, and for how long, basically. And they have interpreted that to say that you can also do that, you know, sort of equivalent data for email and certain internet browsing data as well. There's an argument right now over exactly what's allowed when it comes to internet data. Basically, the FBI was relying on companies having a very broad understanding of what they needed to turn over when they got a national security letter. And at some point, companies kind of, there was a Justice Department memo in 2008 saying, you know, no, you shouldn't be asking for this much. And a few companies kind of wised up and started tightening what they were turning over to the FBI. But basically, there's still a dispute between what the law explicitly says that companies have to turn over and what the FBI sort of reads that to mean. And so it gets really granular. There's like a level of detail in it that's been going back and forth. But there, you know, the FBI was framing this as just, oh, this is just a wording issue. It's no big deal. And there actually was quite a bit of pushback from it, from privacy advocates, from the tech community, and from some senators as well. So we're still seeing how that plays out. But I do think that it's notable that the FBI, you know, still thinks this is a useful power. They still send thousands of these letters each year. So you know, I think it's still something that it's still a powerful tool that they've got.
Right, and it's interesting that you brought up the companies, because I mean, we saw with the blow up between Apple and the FBI and Microsoft and the Justice Department. When the government is so powerful and the surveillance state is so pervasive, it might be up to companies that are worth hundreds of billions of dollars to be the bulwark against these things, because your average citizen and even a publication as prominent as The Intercept, they might not have the tools necessary to fight back. And maybe there's a shift in companies' willingness to do this because of concerns over adoption of products. I mean, whether it's for cynical reasons like your bottom line, or whether it's because you're principled and agree with privacy advocates. I mean, whatever it is, in the post-Snowden era, there's pressure on companies from European citizens who have very different views than us about surveillance in some countries. And there's pressure for their bottom line, and they don't want to give their competitors an advantage by being able to claim that they're more secure and more privacy friendly. So do you see companies as playing a pivotal role? And I know you mentioned Yahoo in your article. Is it up to these tech giants to really be the ones that push back and reveal what's going on? Because otherwise it's going to be difficult for the average citizen to even know when their information's being roped into national security letters?
Yeah, in this context, it's particularly been on companies to disclose some of to sort of push back on the government, because, you know, national security letters, one of the most controversial things about them is that they come with a gag order for the recipient. So, you know, the company, for a long, long time, the company that received them could not even let on that they had one, let alone tell the person whose records were being targeted. They couldn't even say publicly, you know, how many. There's been, you know, the courts have chipped away a bit at that gag order over the past decade, and said that, you know, companies can now disclose in broad ranges the number of, you know, letters they get, and they can actually, earlier this summer became the first company to disclose some actual letters that it had gotten. And my colleague Jenna McLaughlin has done a lot of work on this, but Yahoo is one of the companies that I think stopped providing some of the more granular information that the FBI was, some of the broader requests that the FBI was making. Yahoo started saying, yeah, by the letter of the law, we don't have to provide that, you know, and was giving less. But I think that, you know, one issue is that it's still not clear. Yeah, like you said, maybe European consumers, it's still not clear that American consumers care all that much about this stuff. And, you know, so much of it still does happen in secrecy. I think that we're, like I said, chipping away at it, starting to get these disclosures of what these actual letters even look like. And Nicholas Merrill, whose company was one of the first ones that challenged the national security letter process, has actually been, more and more open about the types of records he was asked to turn over and who the records, the first records were targeting. So I think we'll start to get more information. We're starting to get more information, but the fact is that this has been a tool that's been widely used since
right.
in the post 9/11 area. I mean, tens of thousands of letters sent, and so we've come a long way already with the tool as it's used.
And as you mentioned, there's an ongoing legislative debate about this and whether, what can the FBI do? What can the FBI require of companies? So we'll be tracking that on the podcast for sure. But that's it for today's show. My guest has been Cora Currier, a reporter for The Intercept, and she focuses on national security and human rights. We link to her excellent story in the show notes for today's episode, and make sure to follow her on Twitter. Cora, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks so much.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Let us know what you think of the show, pitch topics and guests. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.